So, good afternoon. Welcome, everybody. So, Dr. Marty Bell from Belmont University and his class are with us today. Could I see the hands of the Belmont students? Great. It's great to have you here today. I think I'd like to, here at the beginning, depart from my prepared remarks and speak to the Belmont students just a little bit. The title of my talk this afternoon is Lessons from Assisi, but we'll come to that in a minute. You have parachuted into what we call the One River Wisdom School of Nashville. And what we do here is we draw from the one river of perennial wisdom that is common to all the great spiritual traditions, which these traditions sink many different wells into this one river. So there are lots of Hindu wells, and there are Sufi wells, Islamic wells, there are many, many Christian wells, Buddhist wells, Jewish wells. And we draw from the living water of all these different traditions. That's our mission here. The Dalai Lama, the titular head of Tibetan Buddhism, was talking about Buddhism once, and he said, you know, Buddhism isn't really a religion. It's a science of mind. And in Tibetan, the word mind doesn't just mean what's up here in the coconut. It's a union of the mind and the heart. So if Buddhism is a science of the mind and the heart, what's its map? What does it teach? And I want to use a couple of metaphors for you so that you can catch this. When you walked into this space for the first time this afternoon, your eyes probably fell on certain things. Maybe the bell. You know, you don't usually see bells like this in Presbyterian churches. One guy sitting up here. Piano. Just the light in this lovely space. And you tuned into sort of the feel, the vibe of the space. All these things are contents and awareness. These are things through that you see through through the eyes. There's also the soundscape, sound of my voice, sound of traffic outside. These two are contents in awareness. In the background of sound is always silence. And in the background of the visual objects in our world is always space. And so what I want to invite you to do for a moment here is just to notice space itself. You notice color and shape and form, but notice what you don't usually notice. Notice space itself. And maybe as you do that, your eyes get a little spacey. And notice what it feels like to see form and color. I see Charles sitting in front of me, his blue shirt. I see the space around him as well. And I notice that when I do that, there's just kind of a relaxation and there's a friendliness toward Charles. There's a kind of intimacy there, even though we're not speaking. Okay? This relaxed, embodied awareness is your, Buddhists would call it true nature, your Buddha nature. It's who you really are. There's all this history that you have. They're your hopes and your dreams and your fears and all these things that come into your awareness. They come and go. But what does not come and go is consciousness and awareness itself. And that's what all these great religious traditions are pointing to. This that does not pass away. Usually, use words in Christianity like eternal. It's always here. It does not pass away. Space. It's here. Different people come in and out of the space, but space is always here. Silence is always here. My voice is here for a while, it won't be here. But the silence is always here. That's presence, that's spirit, if you will, that's God. So let's talk about St. Francis of Assisi. When I was 27 years old, I made my first pilgrimage to Assisi. I took the train from Florence to Assisi, and it being an Italian train, of course there was a wildcat strike in the middle of the train ride from Florence to Assisi. The conductors got out, the engineers got out, they had a smoke for sort of an hour or two, and then they got back on the train and we continued on our way. That's the way trains are in Assisi. It's not like Germany or Switzerland. I got to Assisi, and Assisi is situated in Umbria. It's a hill town, and it's just a gorgeous little medieval jewel. And during the day, it's crowded with hundreds of ginormous tour buses, and people are just pouring in and out of the great churches there, the Basilica of San Francesco. But at night, most of the tourists get back on the tour buses and they go away. And the city itself reverts to its essential medieval character. It's a very quiet, peaceful place. And you see why pilgrims come from all over the world to be in this place. It's full of silence, and this is hard to explain without your being there. I hope you'll go there someday. But the spirit of Francis is very much alive and well there. His humility, his poverty, his spacious poverty, and his enormous mercy. It's all there. It's all there in the air there in Assisi. I stayed at a guest house run by some Catholic nuns called the St. Anthony's Guest House. These were English-speaking nuns. And it looked out on the plain below the mountain on the hill on which Assisi sits, and there are swallows in the evening air, doing their swallow dance. And it's just a magical place to stay. And I had been reading on the train to Assisi the Portable Jung, Carl Jung's writings. Jung was a student, disciple of Sigmund Freud, and he was one of the first people to help us think about the personality in terms of parts. He said, we're not a unified personality, but we've got lots of different parts. And so I was reading Jung as I got to Assisi, but I wandered into the library in this monastery guest house. And there was a book by another disciple of Sigmund Freud's named Karen Horney. She was the first female psychoanalyst, and she was a wonderful thinker. And this book was called Neurosis and Human Growth. I'd heard of her name, but I'd never read her until that moment. But I pulled her book off the shelf. It's just kind of, how you do, kind of thumbing through books. And I thought, oh, this is really worth reading, Neurosis and Human Growth. So when I came back to Nashville, I got a copy of that book. Here's the pith essence of this book, and you can carry it with you today. Karen Horney said that we have kind of three basic moves, three ways of being in the world. We tend to move toward things, we move against things, or we move away from things. And you can think about just kind of how you make your way through your life. Do you tend to, say, when you at or a gathering of students at Belmont, do you tend to move toward other people? Do you tend to move toward the food, toward the drink? Are you a person who's, kind of sizing it up in a little suspicious, or maybe you don't even like some of the people who are there? You kind of find yourself kind of moving away from the experience, maybe even backing off or against. These are just ways of being in the world. I want to give you a kind of a physical experience of this. I want you to take your hands apart like so. Just hold your hands up like this. And then just interlace your fingers. Just bring them together like so. Okay? And I want you to look and notice which thumb is on top. Okay? Is it your left thumb or is it your right thumb? Some of you who've been here before have seen me do this before. So notice which one's on top. Okay? Now what I want you to do is notice, is it right or left? Get that in your mind. And then separate your hands again. And then do it the other way. Put the other thumb on top. Okay? And notice the second way may feel a little weird to you. Like it feels a little off. Or maybe both ways feel just fine for you. Okay? So how many of us had the right thumb on top? Mm-hmm. And left thumb on top? So it looks like about half. I had the left thumb on top. That's the right way to do it. Okay? Not really. Okay? So when we're at home in the world, when we're feeling kind of relaxed and safe and comfortable, it's like this. It's the way you normally interlace your fingers. But when it's not, when we're not so comfortable, when we're feeling just kind of off, you know, we're just off balance, or it just doesn't feel quite right, then it's with the other thumb on top. And we can particularly notice at those off moments, when I'm anxious, do I tend to move toward people? Do I tend to move against people? You know, some people, they just like to roll into a place and roll grenades. You know, they really get off on being against folks. I won't name any names. And then there are folks, and I would say my kind of first move when I move into a strange situation is I kind of step back. I'm just kind of checking it out first. Okay? So there's not a right way to be. There's just a way you find yourself wired. Okay? Now there's a Buddhist take on all this introduction that I've just been giving. And it's a take on this question of who am I? St. Francis had a famous prayer. He would be out under the stars at night. He loved to be out in nature. And he would say, "Who am I, O God? And who are you? Who am I? Who am I, O God? And who are you?" And he would repeat that prayer mantra-like, right? And he was just waiting to see what came. And he got different answers at different seasons of his life. So here's a Buddhist take on this business of moving toward, away from, and against. And this comes from the folks who've been coming here for the last couple of weeks, have been hearing me read from a man named Frank Ostaseski, who is the founder of the Zen Hospice Project in San Francisco. It's where students who have been informed by Zen Buddhism are taking care of folks at the end of their life. The folks they're taking care of don't have to be card-carrying Buddhists. Anybody can come. So here's what Frank says. In the Buddhist tradition, there's an image known as the wheel of samsara. Samsara means the cycle of death and rebirth to which the material world is inextricably bound. You know, the law of the conservation of energy says no energy is ever lost in the universe. It just goes into different forms. My body, when it's at the end of this life, it'll go into a different form. Goes into different energy. Okay? Everything's moving in that sense. That's the wheel of death and rebirth. The wheel as a metaphor illustrates the continuous cycle of conditions that cause us to spin round and round. The engine that drives the wheel is sometimes referred to as the three poisons. There are root causes of our suffering: craving or greed, aversion or hatred, and ignorance, which is also called delusion. At first, poison may seem like a strong word until we begin to recognize the toxicity of these afflictive states and the ways they contaminate our minds, obscuring our natural openness. So what he's saying is that these defensive maneuvers of toward and away from and against, and their Buddhist variants of greed, hatred, and delusion, these tend to cover over or obscure our natural radiance, our natural openness and lightness, which is the core of our being. It's the birthright of every human being. Everybody's got this core of what Buddhists call original goodness. It's there in all of us. It just gets covered over by these, or infected by these poisons. Frank says, I prefer a more contemporary and visceral way of naming these poisons or obstacles. They're called demand, defense, and distract. Craving, the first poison, is a demand that the objects of our desire provide us with lasting satisfaction so we will feel fulfilled, whole, and complete. It is the tendency, and you will recognize this in yourself, the tendency to cling to someone, to something, some idea, and become rigidly attached to it. So we're holding on. We've got the death grip on it. We are holding on for dear life. That's rigid attachment. Greed creates an inner hunger which always has us striving for an unattainable goal. A new job, a new partner, a child, a new car or home, a new body, a new attitude. We think that our happiness is dependent on getting these things, getting what we want. But the problem is, even if we get these things, we find we can get no lasting satisfaction from our accomplishment or possession because everything in life is subject to the law of impermanence. So that's greed or craving or demand. You know? It's just, I just want life to be the way I want it. Right? Everybody knows that. So the second one is the defense of aversion, which can show up as anger, hatred, bullying, loneliness, intolerance, fear. We habitually resist, deny, and avoid unpleasant feelings, circumstances, and people, whatever we don't like or want. Defense traps us in a vicious cycle of finding conflict and enemies everywhere. If you are, and Buddhist psychology talks about craving types, aversive types, and delusional types. If you're an aversive type, you're just wandering around looking to be in a struggle against something or someone. If you're a clinging type, a craving type, you're always out there, you know, hoping that this is gonna do it for me, and do it for me in a lasting and permanent way. The ignorance of distraction is the third poison. It blinds us to the way reality works, giving rise to the tendency to pull, demand, and push, defend against life. We misperceive the nature of things, which is that they're both interdependent and impermanent. Instead, we get lost in a loop of distractions as a way of disconnecting from our pain. Alcohol, shopping, eating, gambling, sex, social media, video games, even meditation can all serve as habits and strategies for distracting ourselves or can go unquestioned. We lose ourselves, we get confused, we hold unhelpful views. We go about our lives in a kind of fog, unable to see clearly that there is a way through our pain which requires us to turn toward it. So I want to talk about turning toward it and how spiritual practice helps us turn toward pain and begin to change it, transmute it into more life-giving ways of being in the world. Once upon a time I was working with a couple, and they're presenting issue. I'm a psychotherapist. That's the way I make my living for you Belmont students. And their presenting issue was the fights that they would get into after they had been at parties when they were drinking. Okay? And the pattern was usually that they'd be drinking and enjoying themselves and having a pretty good time. And then the husband would get concerned, he put it. I'm concerned about my wife's drinking. And on the way home, he would kind of shut down. He would move away. He would withdraw. And she would feel his withdrawal and shut down his judgment. And so she'd get quite disturbed and angry about that, and asking him why the hell he was shutting down. That was her language. And he would then predictably get defensive. And she would get more aggressive, and he would get more defensive, and then he would get more aggressive. And then they were really off to the races and yelling and screaming at each other. And this is the way it always happened. They'd go to a party, they'd drink, this would happen, they'd come home, and they'd have this fight, and they'd go to bed mad. Or they wouldn't go to bed in the same bed. They'd sleep in different places. And then they get up the next morning and never talk about it. Okay? So they're moving against each other and they're moving away from each other. They're distracted. And they just go about their life. You know, they have a child, they're raising this child, they got businesses. And it's just a part of the dance of their life. So, you know, there's a kind of obvious intervention, which is like, notice that something is not happening when you're both drinking. Something's not happening good when you're both drinking. That's kind of obvious. And they got that. That's simple. But what I wanted to work with them on was, and I asked the man, so, what happens when you notice that your wife is having too much to drink? And he said, I get scared. And I said, well, what are you scared of? And he said, well, I'm scared that everything is just going to blow out of control. And I said, well, could we just be with that fear that everything is going to blow out of control and just bring some compassionate curiosity to this fear? That's just Buddhism 101, okay? Bringing compassionate curiosity to whatever is happening in our experience. And remember, the heart of meditation is allowing everything to be just the way it is. So we're allowing this fear to be just the way it is, only we're bringing this kind of compassionate curiosity to it, and we're not judging it. So we're with this fear, and we just see what the fear wants to tell us. And so the fear begins to have memories. It remembers growing up in a New York apartment, and how mother would come home from work. Dad was long out of the picture. Mother would come home from work, and mother was very, very needy. She needed the kids, the 8-year-old and the 10-year-old, to take care of her. She was not really capable of taking care of them. And so they became what we call parentified children. They grew up really fast. They had to take on adult capabilities. So this fear is talking about what it was like when mom came home both out of control and unresponsive, emotionally explosive and unresponsive. And the fear remembered, oh, I used to go down into the laundry room in the apartment building and just be with the hum of the washing machines and the dryers. It was safe down there. That was the safe space in his life. So this compassionate curiosity, this heart of meditation, is just hanging out with this fear. Oh, and of course, mom was a drinker. And we're just being with this fear, and we're invited to talk or not to talk as it wants. There's no pressure, no agenda for it to get anywhere and be any different. And then the fear says, I just feel so vulnerable. And I ask, how old is this fear? And he said, oh, it's forever. I don't have any memories of not feeling vulnerable. So we're just hanging out with this vulnerability. And then just this soft crying comes. You know, when men start crying, tears don't lie in a man. You know, he's crying. I've never seen this man cry before. I've worked with him for some time. Never seen him cry before. And he's just softly weeping. And he says, it was just so sad. It's just so sad. And his wife is sitting in the chair watching all this, witnessing this. And you can see her softening. I mean, they came in and they were ready to fight. They were loaded for bear. But as he's able to make contact and name his fear and his vulnerability and his sadness, you can just see her softening. And she too is beginning to cry, but her tears are tears of compassion now. And he turns to her and he says, I just want to thank you for putting up with me all these years. I think you've known it was here. I was just never able to access it. And on the way out the door, she said, I was pretty skeptical about today. I didn't really think this was going to help. And she said, this really did help. But I got to let you know, I'm still skeptical about whether this is going to last. And I said, you know, we really need to listen to that skepticism. You know, that's a part of her that needs to be honored and needs to be listened to, too, because she's been burned plenty of times before. They both have. The point that I want to make here is that what is driving this whole thing is demand, you know, distraction, you know, greed, hatred, or delusion, moving toward, moving away from, against, all these different things that are pointing to the same thing. That's what's driving it. What's underneath all that is fear. And I want to read you another little story from Frank Ostasevsky about fear in his life. So he's just had 6 hours of bypass surgery, heart surgery. And so his son Gabe and his dear friend Eugene sat by my bedside, and a respiratory therapist abruptly entered the room with great enthusiasm. He said, let's take out that breathing tube and see if you can breathe on your own. It gave me quite a start. I wasn't sure if I could breathe. I shuddered and waved him off, sensing that something was wrong with my left lung. Since the breathing machine left me unable to talk, I scribbled on a notepad, I'm scared. Eugene is a smart, no-nonsense meditation teacher. He intuitively knew what to do. First, he instructed me to sense my body, just the way we started right tonight with the meditation. But I couldn't do it. I got part of the way down my torso before giving up in frustration. Then he asked me to find my breath. And that was even worse. I had been meditating for years, but suddenly I couldn't distinguish between my own breathing and what the machine was doing. I made a panicked motion like I was drowning. You know, I'm drowning here. In that moment, a story I'd heard many times about Suzuki Roshi came to mind. Suzuki Roshi was the founder of the San Francisco Zen Center. He was one of the first great Buddhist teachers in the United States, and was a remarkable human being. So here's the story about Suzuki Roshi. This gentle Japanese man was one of the most revered Zen teachers in America. He was the beginning of the Zen Hospice Project. He'd been a central teacher in my life, even though we never met in person. He practiced and taught meditation for decades with wholehearted dedication. Nevertheless, the night before he died, his youngest son, Otohiro, was lowering him into the bathtub when the Zen master became terrified. You know, Zen masters are supposed to be like totally cool, totally equanimous, you know, like nothing bothers him. He's on the night that he's dying and he is terrified. He thought he might die right there in the bathwater. He started gasping for air and breathing fast. Otohiro spoke quietly in his ear, "Father, calm down. Breathe slowly. Breathe slowly." Otohiro himself began breathing loudly and deliberately, slowly. Hearing his son's words and feeling the rhythm of his son's breath, Suzuki Roshi was able to ground himself and become calm once more. This is not in this story, but I've got to tell you, the last thing that Suzuki Roshi did, he was sitting up in meditation, and he was getting to his last breath. He put his hands up like this, and he made a big Enso, which is the Japanese symbol for wholeness. He made that Enso. He held his hands like that in Gassho, saying Namaste, and he died. That's a good way to go. Okay. So here's the end of Frank's story. If Suzuki Roshi can be scared, then I can be scared too. That's what he said to himself. I told myself, I let myself feel the fear in my bruised and battered heart. Having spent so much time sitting with my breath, I also trusted that ultimately I'd be able to return to it again. Gabe intuitively hears his son, this is pretty cool. His son puts his hand on his dad's heart. It was like a conduit to the very source of love, and it stabilized me immensely. That's what I want my son to do when I've had heart surgery. I pulled Eugene toward me and put my ear next to his face. He understood somehow that I wanted to follow his breath. "Just breathe," he said calmly. "Let the breath breathe you." The sound of his breath and its steady, smooth rhythm became my lifeline. I borrowed Eugene's breath until I could find my own. Gradually, I grew more peaceful, more relaxed. After some time, I motioned for the respiratory therapist to do his work and detach me from the breathing machine. With love and breath, I found my way home. I've got a dear friend named Bruce. He and I were divinity school classmates. And Bruce last year had to have heart surgery. And he was really, really scared, both before and after the surgery. And Bruce, like me, is an Episcopal priest. He's got a deep spiritual life. He was Desmond Tutu's comrade in finding resources to treat AIDS in Africa. He's a wonderful friend, a wonderful human being. But Bruce was really scared around his surgery. And he told me, and I'll have to get through this story. My wife, Kathy, had died a couple of years before. And Bruce had come to visit us in the last months of Kathy's life. He had never met Kathy before. And he spent a little bit of time with Kathy, and then when Kathy died, he and his wife, Banta, drove all the way up from Jacksonville to come here to Kathy's funeral. What happened was that before his surgery, he said, "Gordon, I can't explain this to you, but Kathy came and visited me. I saw her. She was there with me, and I knew it was going to be all right. Love and the breath brought me home." So, 40 years ago, this evening, I was ordained as an Episcopal priest. 40 years ago. What a long, strange trip it's been. If you had told me that I would be sitting here as a Buddhist meditation teacher, teaching in a Presbyterian church about perennial wisdom in all the different religious traditions, I would never have seen that coming. That just was not on my radar screen. It's just amazing how all the pieces of your life will take you where you need to go, even though some of the parts that you go are not, you know, where you particularly wanted to go. There's a famous psychologist named Eric Erickson, and he had this sense of kind of a life cycle of this human life of ours. And he had these antinomies, these opposites. And the very first one in infancy is basic trust versus mistrust. You know, babies have one question. It's, how do you get fed around here? All right? And when babies know that they can be fed and that they're going to be responded to, they're going to be kept warm, and somebody's going to be attentive to their discomfort, then they feel like, you know what? This is a trustworthy place. Right? When they have what we call a good enough mother, then they can feel at home in the world. And then there are all these other stages of life. And the last stage is, at the end of life, is integrity versus despair. And when you've come to a place of integrity in your life, you realize, and these are Erickson's words, integrity is the acceptance of one's one and only life cycle as something that had to be and permits no substitution. That's what integrity looks like. It's the acceptance of your life just as it has been. And that one life may and probably does include lots of kinds of suffering as well. Great delights, many beauties, but real suffering. Suffering of trauma, suffering of racism, of sexism, of... we could go on and on. All of these things are a part of our life. And coming to integrity is not liking all those things, but realizing that they are a part of my life, and how can I meet them and hold them so that I can bring some blessing to the world out of these difficulties and burdens. Houston Smith, the great teacher of religious studies at MIT, said, all religions begin with the cry for help. And that's what religions are about. How do I meet the beauty of my life and give thanks for it? And how do I meet the suffering of my life, the cries for help, and meet that suffering and find some blessing in the core, in the heart of the suffering, and then bring that blessing to other people? That's a life of integrity, I would say. Let's see, one last thing before I stop. When we meditate, most of us meditators, and I've been meditating for 40 years, we really like stillness. We like silence because it's sweet when things get still and things get quiet. It's very refreshing to the heart and to the soul. But if you've been meditating any time, you know that there's noise that comes too. There are thoughts, there are feelings, there are bodily sensations, memories, hopes, desires. This is a part of meditation too. This big A awareness, the presence that I was talking about at the beginning, it does not privilege silence. The silence holds the noise. The awareness holds the silence and the noise, the thoughts. Where the healing comes is this big A awareness, this capital A awareness, this presence, this God space that just holds everything without exception. There's nothing that doesn't belong at the table of meditation. You know, it's kind of like Jesus says, this is my blood. Drink this, all of you. Doesn't say just the nice ones, just the good ones, just the ones who hadn't made any mistakes, just the ones who hadn't had big accidents in their lives, the ones who hadn't blown it. He's saying, everybody here is welcome at this table. Everybody here. And that's what meditation does. It welcomes all the aspects of our lives and says, you're welcome here. Got a place for you. Last thing. I want to come back to my clients who presented with the drinking issue. What we're all looking for is love. If we're lucky, as I was with my wife Kathy, we are able to find that. Someone who's able to say, all parts of you are welcome here. Every part of you is welcome here. We may find people, parents, friends, colleagues, workmates, you know, who can give us a piece of that, but some pieces they can't give to us. It's just not on order. They can't. It's not available. This love that we are all looking for, all the religions join in one voice and they say, it's already here. It's right here in this present moment. It is your true nature. It is this nature that excludes nothing and accepts everything. It actually is your own consciousness, your own awareness. It's always loving you because it's never excluding anything. The hard parts, the sweet parts, sad parts, it's just holding all of you, everything. So this is what we talk about here each Wednesday. You're all from Belmont. You're welcome here any old time. So we end with a little sitting, a little what we call loving kindness meditation. So we'll close our eyes again and sit. So the Buddha taught this meditation to his followers, to his monks, when they came and told him that they were afraid of being in the forest alone. They were afraid of the spirits in the forest. So he taught them this meditation. He told them that they could look the whole world over and they could find nobody more worthy of love than each of them themselves. And he told them to say to themselves, may you be filled with loving kindness and held in loving kindness. May you be calm and peaceful. May you be safe and happy. And may you awaken to the beauty of your own true nature and be free. Be free from fear, be free from suffering. Be free for love and for service. So he taught them to send those wishes to themselves, to each of themselves and to one another. And then he taught them to send those wishes out in ever-widening circles to their loved ones, their friends, to strangers, people they didn't even know. He even taught them to send these wishes of loving kindness to difficult people, people who bothered them, frightened them, upset them. He didn't want anybody to be left out of loving kindness. And finally, he told them to send loving kindness to the four corners of the universe, to all beings, to beings on this earth, two-legged, four-legged, winged ones, to formless beings, spirits, angels, archangels. He said, may all beings be filled with loving kindness and held in loving kindness. May they be calm and peaceful and safe and happy. And may they awaken to the beauty of their true nature and be free. Each week we dedicate the merit of our practice together, the welfare of all beings, to the arising of joy and happiness and peace, and to the ending of suffering. So thank you for your presence and your kind attention. Rami Shapiro, Rabbi Rami Shapiro, and I will be leading a retreat, another One River Wisdom School retreat, On this big A awareness, this capital P presence, at St. Mary Suwannee, not this weekend, but next weekend, you can Google St. Mary Suwannee and find out about that retreat. The meditation Sunday meditation group meets at my home, 5 p.m. Sunday evenings. My home is number 10 Peach Blossom Square. Anything else for the good of the cause? Anybody? Christy, anything? Right. So that information's on Facebook, One River Wisdom School, and our website. So thank you, as always, for your generosity in the Donna baskets, the contribution baskets, and in the back. It helps us pay the rent, support the teacher. Thank you so much.